Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond.
And I'm Claudia Wu. We're the founders of Cherry Bomb Magazine. This season on Radio Cherry Bomb, we're thrilled to share recordings from the Cherry Bomb Jubilee. It took place Sunday, March 29th, 2015, in Manhattan.
This was the second annual Jubilee, which is a one-day conference with some of the most amazing, inspiring women in and around the world of food. This next talk is titled The New Food Revolution. The idea behind this panel was that healthy eating has finally taken hold in this country, and here are several women dedicated to the cause. The moderator is Michelle Promaleko, author and editor-in-chief of Yahoo Food, and the panelists include Caroline Randall-Williams, co-author of the new cookbook Soul Food Love, Michelle Tam, the author and blogger behind Nom Nom Paleo, and Danielle Walker, the best-selling author of the Against All Grain cookbooks.
The panel was introduced by Andy Mitchell, author of the memoir It Was Me All Along. Andy's book is a heartfelt look at the relationship between diet and self. All of these women are an inspiration, and it was great to get them together. Enjoy the conversation, and thanks for listening to this special episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
I'm introducing the New Food Revolution panel. I'm Andy Mitchell. 10 years ago, I stepped on a scale to realize that I was nearly 300 pounds. So it wasn't so much scary so much as the most sobering moment of my life. I saw myself in bigger versions of me. I saw myself only getting bigger, growing to 350 pounds like my dad was before he died of a stroke. I saw myself so far away from anywhere I needed to be, anywhere I wanted to be, and it shook me awake. That day that I weighed myself, I started on a path to change. I started eating healthier, I started exercising, I started cooking, and a year after I'd started, I was down 135 pounds. Of course, thank you so much. Of course, the sad thing that I think those of us who lose weight realize is that there's like no finish line, so it's my journey had just begun. What I realized looking back now is that it wasn't running that changed for total health. It wasn't calorie counting. It wasn't, you know, five small meals a day. Total health is about transforming your relationship with food. It's about transforming your ideas about wellness. It's nourishing from the inside out. This year, I released a memoir because I believe in the power of telling our stories. Because I believe in the power of validating the stories of others, and I believe in the hope that you can give someone when you tell your truth. This panel is here today because each of us has found our way to health, not in spite of food, but through it. Each of these women is fighting for a personal, a national, a global food revolution. Proponents of healthy diet have been fighting this uphill battle for many, many decades. But now it kind of feels like that uphill battle is getting somewhere. That boulder that they've been pushing, it's near the top of the mountain. McDonald's is talking about adding kale to its menus. Soda sales have been decreasing for many years. School lunches are changing. There's many people now who know what it means to eat locally, what it means to eat sustainably. Green juice is kind of popular. Every day, more and more people are demanding to know what's in their food, and that matters. It's a good time. The health revolution that we're experiencing now, it's not perfect, and it's not over yet, but it's here, and the battle cries are really loud, and that's great. The number of people like us fighting this good fight, it's growing every day. And these three special women are here to tell their stories. First, we have Caroline Randall Williams. And she was named one of the 50 people changing the South in 2015 by Southern Living magazine. She's a third-generation poet and author of two books, the most recent being the 2015 cookbook Soul Food Love, co-authored with her mother, which is a collection of recipes that translates the meals and traditions handed down by generations of Black women into easy, affordable, and healthful dishes. Next, we have Danielle Walker. Danielle is the author of the New York Times best-selling cookbook Against All Grain and the award-winning gluten-free food blog of the same name. At 22, Danielle was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, and it led her to make a number of dietary changes to end her suffering. She started her blog to offer hope and help to others who suffer from similar ailments and allergies continue to enjoy food. Finally, we have Michelle Tam, who has been called the Martha Stewart of paleo. She's the creator of the award-winning blog Nom Nom Paleo. Together with her husband, she wrote the New York Times best-selling cookbook Nom Nom Paleo, Food for Humans. In March, that cookbook was nominated for a James Beard Foundation Award. And finally, not last but obviously not least, we have our moderator, Michelle Promolenko. Michelle is the editor-in-chief of Yahoo Health, the former vice president and editor-in-chief of Women's Health magazine, and the author of 20 Pounds Younger, The Life-Transforming Plan for a Fitter, Sexier You. She's a dedicated health journalist who empowers women to live their best lives by bringing them the latest information and advice in all areas of wellness, fitness, and nutrition. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. I think we're all super inspired by your story. And I'm certainly excited to be here to talk to these three food revolutionaries. And in thinking about today's theme, I was reminded of a line from The Hunger Games, which is an apt movie title for today's theme, right? Where Katniss says, every revolution begins with a spark. So I wanted to ask each of you guys what that revelatory moment was or what that spark was that put you on your current path. And Danielle, I want to start with you, because it was really personal and it was critical. It was a health crisis. You needed to get well and strong to care for your infant son. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease when I was 22, just weeks after getting married and graduating college, and it came on overnight. And I spent many, many years sick in the hospital multiple times a year, multiple blood transfusions to save my life. I was on extremely high doses of steroids and medications, and nothing was working. And there was a point where I had started researching food. You know, the medications weren't working. The doctor said that they would. The doctor said that, you know, food wouldn't work. And I just kept thinking maybe something that I am eating or that I'm not eating could be helping or harming me. And so I had kind of done some research on my own and had seen that it actually could work, but I hadn't committed to it mentally because it was a big shift for me. And so when my son was 9 months old, I ended up back in the hospital again. I was bedridden for 3 months. I was hospitalized for about 2 weeks, and there was, you know, he wasn't allowed to come and see me in the hospital, and I couldn't lift him out of his crib. And so that was my turning point. That was my spark, you know, where I just said, I have someone to care for. If I know something that can actually help me, then why wouldn't I commit to that 100%? And so for me, and for hundreds, you know, of other types of ailments and autoimmune conditions, cutting out grains, dairy, legumes, and anything processed was what I had to do. And I had to kind of shift my mindset to not what I can't eat, but what I can eat. You know, I can enjoy grass-fed meats and organic chicken, and I can do, you know, vegetables and berries and fruits and nuts and seeds. And so that sounded like a lot to me. And it was worth it to me because I was able to re-enter into my family, and I was able to take back on all of the things that I was supposed to be doing that so many other people were having to do for me because I spent so much of my time sick.
And you started documenting your experiences, and that's how you started Against All Grain, your blog, and you quickly gathered audience because there was a lot of other people out there who needed the answers, and traditional medicine wasn't doing the trick.
Exactly. Yeah, I started my blog because I was starting to create recipes, you know, all the things that my Italian grandmother had taught me to cook I could no longer use. and I wanted a place where I could keep track of everything. I also wanted to stop having to tell my friends and family everything I was doing because I think they were getting sick of it. So I started a Facebook page separate. You know, I was like, well, if they want to follow me, they can. And just within, you know, a few months, I was already at 50,000. And then, you know, the next year I was at 300,000. And now, you know, 3 years later, 650,000 people, almost a million across the board, are following, and they all have, you know, ailments. There's tons of different autoimmune conditions. There's things, you know, just like migraines and sleepless nights, all sorts of reasons why people are following this way of eating.
Well, one of my all-time favorite quotes is from Anne Wigmore, the founder of the Hippocrates Health Institute, and she said, "The food you eat can either be the safest and most powerful form of medicine or the slowest form of poison." And I absolutely know that to be true. But I find it hard to convince people, my mom especially, that food is that powerful.
Right.
That it can absolutely be harmful, but that it can also heal. So you found a way to communicate that message.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I didn't know that so many people were looking for, you know, health through food when I started my blog. And, you know, it sees 2 million hits a month now, which shows me that there are lots and lots of people looking for recipes and they're looking to heal themselves. And it's very, there's a big awareness, you know. I mean, just gluten intolerance in general, they say, I think there's over 18 million Americans that have some sort of gluten intolerance, not necessarily celiac. And when you eat something that you know bothers your body, then it just, you know, slowly or can even be quickly, can really just deteriorate, you know, your health.
But it's so powerful that I think you wrote that you began feeling the effects of those dietary changes within 48 hours.
I did,
powerful.
It was extremely powerful. That was really hard to look back from. You know, after cutting out those foods within 48 hours, my symptoms were probably 75% improved. And once you see that kind of change, it's pretty difficult to look back. And you really have to kind of start training your brain to look at those foods as kind of the enemy. And the foods that actually make you feel good as, you know, those are the things that I can eat. And that's what makes me feel good. And anything that doesn't make me feel good is not worth it. As much as that baguette looks amazing most of the time, I know how it will feel, you know, for the rest of the week, the month, right, the year. And so I've learned that it's not worth it.
So, Caroline, let's turn to you. Over the weekend, I was reading the New York Times op-ed piece that your mom penned a few years ago, and your mom's your co-author, and she wrote that she wanted to be the last fat black woman in your family, and she also wrote that getting healthy meant not just evolving the foods that you eat, but also addressing the desire that some black women have to be big, and that's not totally comprehensible to some of us, but understanding that made clear that this is an enormous challenge. Changing those eating norms in Southern culture is a huge challenge given those two things. So tell us about that.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the best compliments you can get in the black community is for someone to say you're thick, right? You know, thick thighs, thick whatever it is, because, you know, big can be beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's a very beautiful... and so I think one of the conversations that my mom and I really like to invite is this idea that it's not about getting thin or losing weight, it's about getting healthy. You know, losing 10% of your body fat decreases your risk of diabetes exponentially, for example. So if I'm 200 pounds, I just have to lose 20. You know, I just need to be 180. I don't need to be skinny. I just need to lose 20 pounds. You know, mom said, "I want to be the last fat black woman." And I was like, well, that's easy for you to say because that lets you off the hook. If you're the last fat black woman in our family, that puts it all on me to make sure that I'm not fat.
Right.
But I think that was a really, like, wonderful, I like the onus of that responsibility. And I was, you know, when she wrote that and came out with that, I was, at that time, living in the Mississippi Delta. I still live in Mississippi now. And the Mississippi Delta is a pretty radical food desert. If you guys, I don't know if you're familiar, which is counterintuitive since it's, you know, all agriculture, but it's all soybeans and cotton, and you know, not so much tobacco anymore, but it's all soybeans and cotton and corn, but it's corn that they grow brown because it's used for fuel and for feeding livestock, right? So I would drive to school. I taught public school in Sunflower County for 2 years, and I would drive to school, and I would drive past all these fields, and I would get to school, and all of my kids would be eating, you know, canned fruit salad compote. You know, they'd be eating terrifying hamburgers. You know, they'd be eating government cheese, and they didn't look healthy. I remember I'd bring baked chicken to school. I'd bring steamed broccoli. I'd bring, you know, salmon croquettes that I make without flour, and they'd be like, "Miss Williams, you like a white girl."
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because your mom turned to you when you guys were doing Soul Food Live, and I was wondering, so you had healthful habits despite the environment that you grew up in.
Well, right.
She turned to you for help.
Absolutely. My mom sort of said, well, when my mom said to me, "I want to lose this weight, I want to be the last fat black woman," I was like, great. Because at that point, I'd been living in Mississippi for 2 years. I'd been cooking for myself. I like started emailing her recipes. I was like, let's get on this, you know, because you want your parents to live and live well, right? And so I was so excited to hear, because again, as a supportive daughter, I don't want to say like, "Mom, you've got to change your body." You know, I didn't feel like that was my place. But the second she said yes, I felt this like, such an intense relief, and I said, "Okay, let's get on this train." And then she was like, "Well, where's all this coming from?" And I was like, "Oh, I've been eating well like this, you know, this right. whole time." And I moved to the, and I was raised around these like brilliant black women who were big and had these incredible kitchens, and I sort of love the integrity of that. I love getting in my kitchen. And my mother is a retired country songwriter, among other things. So I was raised in this like very hippie hybrid community, and. So she was eating, she didn't get fat eating terrible food. She got fat just eating a lot of sorts of delicious things. Yeah. So it was not, it, so as long as the recipes were delicious that I was providing her, it wasn't so terrible. But
so Michelle, despite growing up in a family that did a lot of cooking, you got swept up in the whole low-fat misinformation cascade, and you got a degree in food science and nutrition with the ambition of becoming a mad flavor scientist. And of yes. creating Frankenfood, and it's really hard to believe that now, but that's where you were then.
It is, and what's really funny is I bumped into one of my friends from college, and she's like, "Whoa, you're doing, you know, this nom nom paleo thing, and you know, this is like, you know, what do you think Michelle from 20 years ago would think of Michelle now?" And right away I was like, "Oh, she would hate her, like she would hate her and mock her," and partly that's because 20 years ago. I was a lot bitchier, but also because that's 20 years ago when I went to school for food science and nutrition, you know, we were learning about how saturated fat was bad and how you had to go high carb, low fat, and, you know, just better living through chemistry, and there's just all sorts of ways that flavor scientists can manipulate foods to be super delicious. And I was like, "Wow, this is amazing. Like, we can save the world." But what I didn't realize is I just never thought about how I felt, like, when I ate the foods I ate. You know, I always had, like, kind of low-level, baseline GI stuff, which is, like, too much information for this audience. But I thought everybody had it. And, you know, I just never thought, I was like, well, this is like eating this way is supposed to be healthy because everybody is like, people of authority are telling me this is the right way to eat. So I never thought about it. I was like, oh, calorie in, calorie out. As long as I eat less calories, or then I'm like, you know, expending. So I slapped on a body bug to like count how many calories. And I was like crazy. Like I would like run in place at 11:58. I'm like, oh, I haven't like... expended as much energy as I need to, but I never felt great. Like I might have, you know, been skinny, but I think I was just skinny fat with all sorts of GI upset.
Never a cute thing.
And then, you know, I think one day after our second kid was like two, like my husband and I looked at each other and we're like, "Gosh, we got to get in shape." And so he started kind of exploring, you know, different ways of getting in shape, and he stumbled upon paleo. And he was telling me about it, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, you can actually eat, you know, meat again. We don't have to eat tofu, everything. And, you know, maybe we should cut out some of the grains, you know, and eat more vegetables." And I was like, what the? Like, you're going to get a heart attack. Like, you should increase your insurance premiums if you're going to do this. But then he did it, and he totally started feeling better. He had more energy. He was stronger, and he got a six-pack right away. And I'm like, what? And he totally did not even try to convince me at all. To the point where I almost was like, wait, am I not good enough to go paleo? Is that why you're not trying to, like, convince me? But I think he knew that's just how, like, I had to come to the realization myself. And I remember being on an Alaskan cruise with our family, and I was behind someone in line who was in one of the scooters with, like, an oxygen tank. And I saw them, like, filling their plate with, sorry, this is, with, like, what they thought was healthy. And I was like, this is awful. Like, you know, they're being taught that this is the way to eat. Like, they're putting, like, all this whole grain waffles with, like, no sugar syrup. And, you know, they're trying to be healthy, but it's not working. So then I just was like, I'm going to go paleo on this cruise. And because I'm kind of an all-in kind of person, that's what I did.
Awesome. One of the common threads throughout all of your cookbooks and your eating philosophies is that to be sustainable, healthy eating has to be easy, it has to be affordable, and most importantly, it can't sacrifice creativity and taste. Mm-hmm. So, looking at your cookbooks, they're a testament to that. But Michelle, you still think that there's a disconnect in the public consciousness between the idea that food can be both delicious and healthy. It's not an either-or proposition.
I think there can be a disconnect, because I know when I was, like, eating healthy all the time, I didn't care that something tasted like cardboard. I'm like, this is healthy. This is 100 calories. This is good for me. But, I mean, I know for me, because I am just such a die-hard food lover, and there's actually a phrase in Cantonese called waisik. Like, are there any Cantonese people in the house? So it means, like, you know, live to eat. And that is how, like, my whole life I've just felt like food is everything. And so when I went paleo, like, a lot of people were like, oh, wow, you're, like, you know, cutting out all these foods. And I'm like, no, now I can eat short ribs. And I can eat all these things that I didn't
Reason
eat before.
Enough right there.
Right? And so I actually, there's a lot of times where I don't feel like there's anything missing. But I also know how hard it is to cook. Like, because everybody's busy. Like, I worked night shift for 12 years, and I had two kids. And I'm lazy. So I, like, for my recipes, I always tried really hard to make simple yet delicious recipes that would turn out the first time. And I have, like, step-by-step pictures on my blog just so people will know exactly how to make it. Because I know that, you know, buying high-quality food is expensive. Like, no, it is expensive. And your time is precious. And you want it to taste good the first time, or else you will never freaking do it again. You're like, that's it. I wasted all this time. I'm never going to cook again. And so that is, like, my overriding, thing for all my recipes, is that it should be simple and easy, and they can work the first time. Because if they don't, I find out right away if they don't.
Yeah, well, I was flipping through all of your cookbooks in the office and salivating all, you know, over the beautiful imagery and the delicious sounding recipes. And Carrie Diamond made the comment that if you hadn't seen the cover and you didn't see the paleo language and you didn't see the healthy language, that they would just be amazing cookbooks on their own merit. So that's the point. So when it comes to recipe development, do you think first and foremost about the nutritional components, or Danielle, almost the medicinal components? Or are you starting with what's going to be a great tasting recipe?
I come from what's going to be a great tasting recipe, because that's where I started
you
from.
Back
I'm not a nutritionist.
Part.
Yeah, I'm not a doctor. I kind of come from, honestly, I was 22 years old and I had this fear I was going to have to eat, you know, grilled chicken and steamed broccoli for the rest of my life. And so I came from a place of, I want to recreate everything that I miss. So my first book is kind of all of that. You know, it's that all-encompassing. You can have your, you know, lemon meringue pie that you remember that your grandmother made, or you can send your child with cupcakes, you know, to a birthday party. You can have everyone over for Thanksgiving and still get to enjoy all the food and the memories that you, you know, remembered from the past. My second book kind of went along the lines of trying to make it more simple.
Well, that's amazing, because it isn't about giving up. It's just about being super creative and replicating it.
It's true. Yeah, it is. And it takes a lot. You know, I mean, it's different ingredients. Not everyone knows how to use coconut flour or almond flour. So it was a lot of time spent in my kitchen just experimenting, because there's really no science for that. You know, there's not really ratios for it. There's not cooking schools that teach you how to use, you know, nut flours. And coconut oil and things like that. So it was a lot of experimentation. And because there were so many people wanting to do this, and because those ingredients are so expensive, I kind of dedicated my time to really creating foolproof recipes that if they bought those, you know, new ingredients and they revamped their pantry, that they wouldn't end up with a bunch of stuff that tasted like cardboard or that fell apart or, you know, didn't taste enough like kind of the thing that they remembered it, or where they'd have, you know, half empty bottles of things in their fridge that they would never use again. And so it was kind of both of those things of recreating the tastes and textures, but also making it sustainable for people.
Since we're talking about the new food revolution, I wanted to ask you all if there was this epiphanal moment where you felt like, wow, we've really reached a tipping point where healthful eating is going mainstream. I know for me it was, and Andy touched on this, when McDonald's announced that they weren't going to serve antibiotic-laden chicken and that they might actually be serving kale after saying they would never serve kale. Did you guys, what about you guys? Any moments where you're like, yes, we've reached that tipping point?
I recently, my favorite place to get my nails done, because I live in Oxford, Mississippi, and have to drive to Memphis. Wild down there, y'all. Anyway, my favorite place to get my nails done is run by a woman named Ebony. And I was sitting, and you know, you have to wait, these like black salons, you have to wait because like people come for their hair, they come for their nails. And if you came at noon and somebody else got there at 9, like good luck getting out of there before 4. So I'm sitting in there with all these ladies, and I brought a copy of my cookbook for Ebony. And these two older ladies are sitting and they're eating like some pasta salad thing that I don't even know, that none of us, I think, might approach on this panel here. But anyway, they're sitting there, and they're so flipping through my cookbook, and I'm sort of keeping my mouth shut about it, because you get, especially these older people, healthy soul food. Like, is that a thing? Is that possible? And then this one lady says to Ebony, she goes, "Look here, Ebony, we're not just talking to you about cucumbers yesterday, how we need to fix some cucumber something." And I was like, yes, like, we need to fix some cucumber something. Like, this belongs to us. We're allowed to cook this. This is in a soul food cookbook, and it's speaking to these women. And I was like, okay, I got this. I can now launch into my healthy soul food platform. And we talked about it for a little while after that, but it was really awesome.
It's awesome. It happened in a nail salon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What about you guys? What was the moment where you were like, yes, tipping?
I have a few different ones. I think for me, just seeing how fast everything grew and just getting the response that I got and hearing, you know, from just the hundreds of thousands of people that were finding health through food was huge, just to hear that it wasn't just me. I think this year specifically, my book was one of two paleo books or grain-free books on the top 10 best-selling cookbooks of 2014. And to see, you know, mine and that other one kind of ranked up there with ones that appeal to the entire nation, you know, that can eat at everything, that don't have food intolerances, was pretty eye-opening to see, wow, there actually is a need for this. This is actually, you know, not a fad. I've been doing it since, you know, 2007 or 2008, and it's just continually growing. And so to see it kind of reach the mainstream, you know, I made Forbes 30 Under 30 this last year, and it's all doing what I'm doing and just spreading kind of my story and spreading the recipes. And so it has mainstream traction, which I think for me was seeing, wow, okay, you know. And then also on that of just seeing, you know, gluten-free and dairy-free options popping up everywhere. You know, I think they said the gluten-free industry is going to be like $5 billion this year or something of that sort. Or being able to go into restaurants and talk to the servers or the chefs and have them have awareness of, you know, some of these food intolerances. That was not so when I first started. And so I've seen it grow. And it's been
pretty
amazing.
Sometimes your server will ask you outright, do you have any intolerances? Do you have any allergies? And that was never a question.
Right. And so that's great to see, you know, that on the rise and to see people really trying to create things. You know, we can't obviously do everything for everyone, and there's not a one size fits all, but it's nice to see the awareness and people really trying to accommodate those things.
Michelle, what about you?
So I think there were a few. I think, like, for me, when Food Inc. became such a huge movie and everyone was talking about it, like, that was such an eye-opening movie for me, because I was like, oh, I know everything. Like, I'm, you know, I buy organic and I buy things that are properly labeled. But when I watched that, I was like, holy moly, this is crazy. You know, I will never eat, you know, a burger from that fast food chain again, you know. And, you know, and then I think when the Chipotle Scarecrow film. Have you guys seen it? It was like on YouTube, and it went viral. And it was just talking about factory farming and the fact that Chipotle won't serve carnitas if it's not from a well-sourced pastured pig is pretty cool. And I think, like, just the other day, I think it's really funny and cute that, like, Shailene Woodley, that actress in Divergent, is, like, going on all these talk shows and saying how she drinks bone broth and thinks crickets are the way to go for the future. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And it's getting press, and she's, like, such a...
So crickets on the menu at McDonald's, that's really...
Well, that,
we
yeah.
We know we've made it then.
But, I mean, these things are just, you know, aren't crazy, like, hippie talk anymore.
Great. So switching topics a little bit, Michelle, we're talking about who's moving the needle and how it's all happening, and you have some ideas about millennials moving the needle. And for those of you who don't know, millennials are those who are 18 to 34. Yahoo, we spent a lot of time thinking about them, right, Carrie? So how are millennials pushing things forward?
I think that they are totally helping move the whole movement forward. I mean, you guys are here, millennials. Like, I'm like the old lady on the panel. But
I think that would be me, but...
No. But it's... I think it's amazing. Like, kids are just learning so much from YouTube, and when things go viral, and it's like, it forces transparency. And I think it's... And I think millennials are way more, you know, critical, and they are critical thinkers, and... I think it's fantastic. I think social media is a really great way to get information out. It's a great way to connect with people. Like, you can connect, like, if you're not happy with something a large corporation is doing, you can tweet them. You can do all sorts of things. And I think it's just amazing. Like, I think for, like, my generation, you just kind of took everything for granted, that you were getting the right information. And I just love now that you can find out someone's lying and then it goes viral on Twitter and then everybody knows. It's just like, you know, and then there's a hashtag for it. So I think it's...
Questioning authority.
Yeah, I think millennials are awesome. Like.
So clearly demand and expectation is part of it, mm-hmm. but then access is also part of it. And Caroline, you were just saying a few seconds ago that you live in a food desert, but you also believe that whether you shop at Whole Foods or Walmart, that you can eat healthfully. So how do you do that?
Well, absolutely. And another revelation that I had was, you know, Walmart is the single largest purchaser of organic produce in the country. And I think a lot of people are, you know, don't know that. I certainly had never been to a Walmart before I moved to Greenwood, Mississippi. Not certainly, that's pretentious. I had never been to a Walmart before I moved to Greenwood, Mississippi. And now I, like, can freely say that it totally is saving my life. You know, Walmart is my best grocery store option where I live. And, you know, there are CSAs and stuff like that, but, you know, try telling a mother of four children who doesn't have a car and lives in Greenwood, Mississippi, you know, and her closest grocery store is a Big Star, like, try telling her that she needs to eat organic to be healthy, and she'll be like, forget you, I'm going to Popeyes. You know, like, I have six children, and this is a really hard life. So I think part of my, sort of one of the ways that my message has been formulating is to say, like, obviously, like, I was raised eating organically, eating very healthfully. Like, I love to seek out farm-raised things, but that is not the only way. Like, there is not, it's not, like, all in or all out. You know, like, you can take steps. Like, if all you can get is frozen vegetables, fill your freezer with them. You know, fill your freezer with frozen vegetables. Don't go and get macaroni and cheese at Popeyes. Like, buy some peas and some broccoli and some spinach and put it in the microwave. You know, like, that is... So I think that that's, like, one of my big missions is to... And I think that by the same turn, like, when I'm approaching recipes, I'm all about, like, I have, like, core things that you should just keep in your kitchen so you can throw something together conveniently. And when I'm coming up with recipes, I'm thinking about, like, what am I telling people to keep in their kitchen? Like, sweet potatoes, onions, garlic, like, frozen chicken, like, things that then you can, like, do spices and add here and there and, like, pull things together swiftly. But it's all about those, like, foundational things, because a lot of these people, it really is that hard to get food, make food. And so I just like want to strip away all snobbery about, like, you know, I agree, like there are places I would never eat the burger, but there are also people who I would say, go there, get the burger, take the bun off and like eat the meat, you know, like figure out something that works, you know, because it's all about what you actually have access to.
I think that's such an important message. We've been talking a lot about, yes. So we've been talking a lot about industry and what restaurants are doing and what chains are doing, but to my mind, to revolutionize the dinner table for the better, you know, we really need to grasp how much food and emotions are intertwined. You know, we eat to celebrate, we eat to mourn, we eat to reward. And I think in a lot of families, sugar equals love and things like that. So how do we begin remapping those family patterns? Anybody? Anybody?
For me, it's not about remapping. I think it's just about kind of transferring some of them over. You know, I mean, we still do love those things. And so that's kind of why I've tried to recreate them, but in a healthier version. But, you know, you don't want to forget the memories that you had growing up with your family around the table. You don't, you know, I had a mom that came up to me that had been bedridden for many years, and she was like, thank you so much for allowing me to be able to actually bake chocolate chip cookies with my daughter again. You know, not only is she feeling well enough to get out of bed, but she can make, you know, a gluten-free option and enjoy that memory, that pastime. So I think it's about switching out, you know, ingredients for certain things, you know, using like a low glycemic sweetener instead of a processed refined sugar, or using coconut oil, which is heart healthy, you know, instead of some of the, you know, Crisco or something of that sort. So I think it's about making those kind of small changes, but not trying to lose, you know, those things. Yeah, not rewarding necessarily with a cookie or something like that, but getting to still have those things. And, you know, for me, I have a four-year-old, and I don't want him to feel ostracized. You know, I want him to still be able to go to a birthday party and still be able to maybe take something with him and enjoy it, or go to his school and not be, you know, the kid that's eating carrots when everyone else is getting to have a cupcake. Because kids, you know, they enjoy those things. And especially kids who have some sort of an ailment or a disease. You know, I have a big following for families that have autism and Asperger's that use this way of eating to help those symptoms. And those kids feel different enough already. So to not be able to enjoy good food and actually have, you know, the kind of things that are tied to good food is really important. So that's kind of my stance on it.
No, I think that's important. So it's not eradicating, it's just tweaking so that you can keep those, the sort of emotions and food connections that we're sort of conditioned to think about certain foods and what they mean to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. You know, I mean, obviously there's the other side of it where if you're unhealthily eating too much, you know, to for feelings or for things like that, that's kind of something
different. We don't
want
to eat our feelings.
Yeah, don't eat your feelings.
But that's like a really real concern, the eating of the feelings. Like my grandmother, my mother, like, even I, like, had a natural impulse to self-medicate with food, like panic, crisis, especially if you need to be, like, functional mentally. Like, you know, there's a lot of people that turn to, like, Xanax or to a drink or something. But if you're needing to be on point and have, like, you know, expectations of demanded of you, then, like you're saying, reaching for the chocolate, you're reaching for the potato chips, you're reaching for these things that are helping you through crisis, right? That are, and so I think, like, On the other side of it, you know, soul food, people, they're like, it's candied yams, it's fried chicken, it's all of this. But I have one of my dear friends who's really struggling with obesity, diabetes. She's having kidney problems, and she's got two sons, and she's 38, and she's amazing. But she, you know, came over to my house. I cooked her dinner, and she was like, you know, my mother-in-law was in my house last month talking to me about she was like, Ruthie, you got a cake up in this house every single week. You bake a cake every single week. And Miss Collins was, I call her Miss Collins because I met her as a co-teacher. And Miss Collins was like, well, my boys love cake. And her mother-in-law said, you know, back in my day, we had cake like twice a year. It was celebration food. We couldn't afford to make it. We couldn't afford to make it every week. It wasn't accessible. And it sort of spoiled the fun of it if you eat it all the time. And so Ruthie and I had this sort of revelation together that one of the problems is that we've conflated celebration food and everyday food, especially in the Black community. Like, these things that we think of as soul food are what we were eating like three times a year. And what were we eating the rest of the time? Like, when we were working from can't see to can't see, you know, so like reviving the things that were like actually getting us by is like one of my big things, one of my big missions.
Right. I know dessert has somehow become the automatic meal ender when it doesn't have to be.
To do what Chinese people do and just have a plate of fruit.
Yes, on an orange. So in my research, I dug up some fun facts about our panelists, so I wanted to ask them about them. Caroline, you own 1,000 cookbooks, so... it's grown to 2,000. So I want to know, first of all, where do you store them? And second of all, how do you decide which one to cook from?
Oh, my gosh.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
Well, my grandmother left them to me when she passed away. She was a librarian and compulsive book buyer. You know, we saw the Kitchen Arts and Letters table out there. She used to order from them, and I still find order slips from Kitchen Arts and Letters all the way in Nashville, Tennessee. She was a librarian at Fisk University. So I keep them in... I grew up in a 1913 house that they had to add the kitchen on when kitchens became a thing. And so it runs the entire back length of the house. And like basically all of the walls that aren't windows are floor-to-ceiling shelves of cookbooks. And I don't think that they all even fit up there. There's some in my bedroom. And when I was little, I used to just pick by like title. I mean, there was one called the Jewish-Japanese Sex and Cookbook. And when I was like... When I was like this little 11-year-old black girl in Nashville, I was like, yeah, that one sounds wild, you know? I'm like, so it was really about that. And then, you know, when my mom and I went to write the cookbook, we actually spent a summer cataloging every single one and going through them. So now I really know what I have, and I sort of approach the collection with purpose. But it really is just sort of fun to play like, close your eyes
like
and point.
Turn around and point.
Oh, totally.
Swirl around and
totally.
Point. Totally. That's awesome. So, Michelle, you mentioned this earlier. Until very recently, you worked the graveyard shift as a pharmacist for 12 years. What did you learn about health and wellness from all of those sleepless nights?
Well, yes, it is. I worked for 12 years as a zombie drug dealer. And for a long time, I was convincing myself that I had it all dialed in, especially after I started eating paleo. I was like, oh, I have so much more energy. I'm not really narcoleptic. But the main thing is you really, even though there's a big need for people to work different shifts because otherwise hospitals wouldn't run, and if you called the police in the middle of the night, no one would come over. It really is hard on your body to go against, you know, your circadian
biorhythms.
Yeah. And I realized when I finally quit my job in July that I've probably been jet lagged for the last 12 years, and my memory was not that great. And I'm a much nicer mommy now.
And we have to add that she was able to give up the graveyard shift because Nom Nom Paleo is doing so well, right?
Yes, yay! That's part of it. Thanks.
So Danielle, I saw in one of your recent video blogs that you were actually able to eat gluten-free at Disney World. Mm-hmm. And I'm wanting to know how you were able to swing that in the land of funnel cakes.
Yeah, it does smell of churros all over the place, and it's definitely tantalizing. But, you know, it was actually really doable. We're a big Disneyland family. It was actually Disneyland, but Disney World,
Disneyland,
you know, I hear from
right,
a lot
the
of people, too. Yeah,
one.
Yeah. But they're really, really great at it. You can get, like, a map of the Disneyland, and it shows you where you can get gluten-free options. They'll tell you where they have soy-free options, dairy-free
options.
Well,
that's the epiphanal moment.
It's pretty amazing,
like,
yeah.
Like, the map of Disneyland gluten-free restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's when we know we've reached a tipping
right,
point.
Right, right. And, you know, not only that, but I was going to the different restaurants and asking, and at first I thought, you know, I'm an author and a blogger. That's why they're sending out the chef, because they just want me to not give them, like, a negative review or something. But it actually, they do it for everyone. If you tell them you're gluten-free, the chef comes out. He walks you through the menu. He tells you what they can do. They switch their gloves. They switch their grills. You know, everything. If you, especially if you have celiac or like a serious allergy to it, they switch their fryers to make you, you know, gluten-free sweet potato fries. It's pretty incredible. They do lettuce-wrapped burgers, gluten-free buns. You know, it's and even at some of the quick places, not like necessarily the $40, you know, entree. They actually do it at some of the kind of grab-and-go places as well. I was pleasantly surprised. Yeah,
that's incredible. Okay, we're getting near the end here, so this is pretty much going to be the last question. I wanted to know, what can the rest of us do to be healthy eating revolutionaries? Any advice for the rest of us so we can help you in this movement?
I think just find something you're passionate about and spread your story. You know, that's what I've decided. I don't tell anybody that, you know, what I do works for everyone. It's just I share my story, and then I like to share all of my fans' stories as well, because theirs are always slightly different than mine. They don't have the same disease as I have. You know, they're not struggling with the same thing. But just to find something that you really believe in and just to share it with kind of a pure intent, you know, not trying to force anything down anyone's throat. I know for me, it was, that's what I had to do, you know, to get some of my family to change their eating habits, was just show them, you know, cook for them and say, like, how do you feel after this, you know? Or people that were losing weight say, great, you lost, you know, 100 pounds, but how do you feel? Like, really get in tune kind of with the way your body feels. But do it from a place of kind of love and not trying to force anybody to do anything.
I think it's making the commitment to cook your own meals. And I know how hard that is, you know, and I was super resistant to it. I was like, I'm too busy. I'm going to outsource it. There's all this great delivery stuff where we can get takeout. We live in the Bay Area. I can totally go out and get all sorts of great food. But you know what? Instead of watching like another episode of The Real Housewives, you can probably make like a, you know, a bunch of food that'll last you for a few days. Like just leftovers and cook your own food is kind of my big thing.
And I think mine would be to piggyback on that, like, just do smart grocery shopping for yourself. You know, like, keep your kitchen stocked so you don't come up short and it's, like, Thursday evening and you're like, I've got nothing and I'm going to go eat out. Like, keep stuff that you know you can make something with. Like, keep brown rice, keep sweet potatoes, keep onions, keep, you know, olive oil and cayenne pepper and all the things that don't go bad very quickly. You know, keep some frozen stuff so that you don't have an excuse. And hold yourself accountable, and also like remember that the struggle is real, but the joy is too. You know, like it's not so arduous. And if you do have to go out, don't punish yourself psychologically about it. Just don't make dumb choices.
That's great. So with 35 seconds left, I wanted to close with a quote from the same op-ed that I talked about earlier that Caroline's mom wrote. And she said, people who know the problem intimately find their way out, then lead a few others. The few become millions. So let's thank these three ladies for helping show us the way.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.